As we continue the study of how to use the law of God, let us look at an example of point 5 in the Larger Catechism, question 99, that every particular duty is not to be done at all times. It's like the duty to eat. Sometimes you can't eat. You're not in sin. You're busy, or whatever the case is, sleeping too long, have to work all day. Okay, you're supposed to sleep. That's another commandment. We don't think of it that way, but certainly we're supposed to preserve life, and sleeping and eating preserves life. These are all positive commands, but sometimes you cannot do them. In fact, sometimes you're not supposed to do them. You're not supposed to eat at work all the time, or eat in front of somebody while you're having a business meeting or having counseling. Like when you're at work, you're not supposed to be there with your parents, even though you're called to honor your parents, so that every particular duty is not to be done at all times. You can't do it all the time, any of these positive commandments, because you got to do other things. That's the nature of those commands and nature of being finite. The negative, however, to these positive commands is not doing it. You're not supposed to lie. You're not supposed to murder. That's the negative, okay? That's important to point out here again in understanding how to apply and use the law of God and how it works to the whole question of the limits of the submission of authority. How can we go to these texts and understand how they answer this question of if and when we should submit to authority or even resist authority? So, does this mean we've just answered this question? Does this mean that it's always our duty to pass laws at every opportunity or every possibility, or probability is a better word, with respect to abortion? The answer is no, because circumstances may dictate otherwise. The whole thing hinges on where you are in the political scheme of things, what kind of authority you have, and what other issues are involved at the time of trying to pass a law to preserve life. So I'm going to narrow down the question. If it is within the politician's power to restrict some abortions, should he? You see, that's a more narrow question, isn't it? Because I specify within his power and by implication, therefore, opportunity to exercise said power. One cannot stop doctors from committing abortions. Can the politician? This is all legal again. I'm talking about defunding the agency employed by the doctors. If you can't stop the doctor, you go to court and arrest the guy for murder, then the politician could defund the agency that employs the doctors. That's one way of doing it. Under what moral grounds? Number 5, 7. We haven't gotten to 7 yet, but yes, 7 and 6 of the Larger Catechism, question 99, would cover this question as well. We're just covering 6, and 6 is one of the big ones. That under one center duty, all of the same kinds are forbidden or commanded, together with all the causes, means, occasions, and appearances thereof, and provocations thereunto. Under one duty, I'm going to summarize it for you. This is number 6 on the back of the page, the handout. Together with all the causes, means, occasions, appearances, and provocations. Is not the agency, therefore, a means to the end of murder? And this is under the positive duty to protect life, that you can defund it. That's one way of protecting it, through the means, causes, and occasions, and things that provoke thereby. Does this make sense? I'm giving you a specific moral way of thinking, instead of just jumping and saying, well, obviously, I should stop funding agencies that fund abortion. It's not that obvious for a lot of people. You'd be surprised. But if you have a clear grasp of the Word of God and how it tells us here, and therefore how it's applied, how the Bible text is applied here by these principles, then we have a better idea of how to deal with the question of resisting tyrants. We've covered this last week, number 6, so what I'm doing here is a summary of what we've covered thus far. So one can stop a doctor from committing abortions by defunding the agency, firing the doctors, getting rid of the agency, getting rid of the politicians who support the agencies. These are all means, causes, and occasions that lead up to the violation of that law of murdering a child in the womb. And thus, they're all legitimate reasons to go after that. Yes, yes, that's true. You can encourage people. That's another means by which you can accomplish this noble goal. Again, any one of the means aren't necessarily required at any given moment, because they're positive duties. Remember, they're not negative duties. It's thou shalt preserve life. What are you going to do to preserve those babies' lives? So sometimes, because what that means is we'll have debates as Christians, we'll debate on what we think is the best positive duty, the best command, and best way to accomplish that command, to undermine these bad laws and therefore support life, right? And good Christian men and women will disagree on this. That's where the debate is for us. Are there not debates in the anti-abortion pro-life movement exactly on how is the best route? Of course. That's because positive duties don't always have to be done at all times. So we debate over when is the best time to exercise and what power, what opportunity, and under what conditions. That's important, again, to remember when we go over the questions of the limits of submission to government. Yes. Thou shalt not steal. Sure. One could argue that because of the end, that is murder, but taxes in themselves aren't necessarily stealing. You've got to watch that argument. If you argue that way, then Christ was involved in paying taxes, and therefore he was involved in stealing. Remember, he paid taxes. We have the occasion for that in the Bible. And he tells us we're going to pay taxes because we don't want to offend authorities over us. Now, to continue on here, the last thing we covered was point 6, the larger catechism question 66. And we went over the example such as there is no explicit text in the Bible requiring translations. No explicit text in the Bible that demands reading. And that wasn't the kind of society they were in. They didn't have books the way we do today. They memorized vast portions of the Bible. And then we conclude here with the provocations. We usually use the word very negatively today, right? Don't taunt, don't irritate, don't instigate your siblings. Quit provoking your brother or your sister in the car. When you put your hand over the visible line, that's their half of the car and this is your half of the car. Every kid did that, right? Of course you did. We all did. That's provoking. The flip side is we're supposed to positively provoke or urge to encourage. And goad is the word sometimes we use in the Bible. It's a sharp stick. It's supposed to goad us into good works, right? And then some of the practical consequences of these rules, first rules we've covered thus far, that is the means, causes, occasions, and provocations thereunto, point 6 of the larger catechism question, are built in and applied in any commandment such as thou shalt work. Let's see how this is. What's implied, therefore, is you should take the means, occasions to get to work. The commandment of God is if you don't work, you don't eat. So the flip side of that, of course, is you should work. We know that intuitively, even without the Bible. But how? How do we get to work? If that means walking or driving, God doesn't care insofar as he's given us freedom to accomplish the means, as long as they're legitimate means. You've got to get it done. And that's built into these laws. Whatever causes, means, occasions can accomplish the goal of working, you should do. So from this understanding of the law of God, we have things like businesses. For instance, there is no commandment in the Word of God that says, thou shalt create businesses. But it came naturally from natural law and the association of people finding out there are better ways to do things. Someone else has a different ability than I do, so we get together and capitalize on our strengths and abilities with synergy together, create a business so we can give better things to our neighbors. There's nothing wrong with that. That's the origins, the means, the causes, the occasions to help propagate the good of your neighbor. The same with schools and even government to a large extent, to the best versions of government, of course. Yeah, there are a lot of these things in life. And that's one of the things I pointed out going through the book of Deuteronomy when I preached through it, when it talked about the different officers. And I went through, if you recall, the litany of texts in the Old Testament talking about different hierarchies of officers from the time of King David and Solomon and onwards. They are expanding in the Old Testament. Where did that come from? God didn't say, hey, go ahead and expand your bureaucracy, King David. Here it is in Exodus 55. No, it's there by good and necessary implication. If the government, society gets bigger, there are more people, and you're going to have a bigger bureaucracy to deal with those things. Even the best bureaucracies. It's just the name of the game. It's just the way it is, unless you want to make society smaller, which might be a good idea. It might have been a good idea for America to be smaller. But that's another question. Lastly, we're done with point 6. Point 2, the law of God as spiritual, so it reaches the understanding, the will, the affections, and all other powers of the soul, as well as words, works, and gestures. That's point 2 of the larger catechism question 99. This is what I call the depth of the law, and the metaphor of the puzzle cube that I talked about, where you could take up all the parts separate from one another, the 8 principles, and put them back, and you have the unity of God's law. This is what I call the depth of the law. As I said, your fingers, what do you do with your hand? Giving someone the finger, remember? You know that phrase, giving them the bird. It's therefore forbidden, because the law of God is spiritual, reaches the understanding, the will, and the affections, and all other powers of the soul, as well as words, works, and gestures. There's no commandment that says, thou shalt not give the finger, but there are commandments to honor one another. Is giving the finger honoring somebody? It is not. Other nations don't understand and recognize the bird, in American parlance, as we do, that doesn't change the fact that it's wrong to give someone the bird. We've decided that that's a way to express a certain heart attitude. And if you want to express your heart attitude that way, that's the way to do it. but you shouldn't because it's forbidden. The names, how you say things, your actions, your will, your emotions, and of course your conscience, all these are wrapped up in the commandments of God. So when it says you're not supposed to murder, you're not supposed to have the heart for murder either, or have gestures towards murder. That's the spiritual aspect of the law, and that's what we're talking about here in this point. We're talking about the inward, but also the outward actions in your mind and your faculties and alike. So what this means is with gestures, names, and actions and alike, so when the president, that's the example we've used before, Obama, spoke up and said what really surprised us all, right? I'm for homosexual marriage. He should have done that. And here's another law that tells him not to do that. It's very detailed what we have here. It's not just, well, I think it's kind of wrong or uncomfortable. It's not the social thing to do. No, your gestures, your words, your actions should support the positive laws of God, the good things. It should never be done to support the negative or what is forbidden. And homosexual marriage is forbidden. Therefore, the president is forbidden to support it publicly with words or gestures or actions. Then today we have the law explained in more detail in this class. I'm going to cover three important principles. Four important principles for the tools of the law. The first one is that the law is binary. We'll cover that in a second. In other words, there is that which is commanded implies that which is forbidden. And this is point four of the larger catechism question. Where there is a duty commanded, the contrary sin is forbidden. And where a sin is forbidden, the contrary duty is commanded. Thou shalt not murder means you should preserve life. You should not bear false witness means you should tell the truth. You should not dishonor your parents. You should honor your parents. It's binary. That's the language I use as an ex-electrical engineer. Except in Christian liberty, and then that's with respect to external actions, because in Christian liberty, whatever you do should be done into the glory of the Lord, in faith. That's the positive thing. It's either that or it's not faith. It's not done to the Lord, that which is a sin. It's a heart attitude there in Christian liberty. The heart attitude is always there in all acts of God. So, it's binary here in this particular point. It's positive or negative, one or the other. And that's a tool for you to learn the law of God. You see a commandment, the negative of that commandment is forbidden. The negative commandment you see, the positive of that commandment is that which is commanded. Another tool in using the law of God and exploring the Bible and mining it for its riches and ethical thinking is the syllogism. Where in the Bible does it give us the Trinity? The word Trinity is not there. Anybody, I've gone over this before back when I went over the larger catechism question 99 about 3 years ago. Yes, right. That's the minor premise, isn't it? There's a major premise and a minor premise. This is how we think, at least implicitly, and that's what logic does to help us to explicate what we do implicitly as humans made in the image of God, a God of rationality. The major premise is that which has the attributes of God is God, right? That's the given. We don't think that way. We forget about that. But that's how the argument should be laid out in the syllogism. That or who which has the attributes of God is God. We can all agree upon that. Even unbelievers can agree upon that. They would say, I don't think there is a God, but if there was a God, that which had the attributes of God would be God. That's another debate. And you have the minor premise. Christ has the attributes of God. Therefore, Christ is God. Major, minor premise go together and draw a necessary conclusion. That's how syllogisms work. That's how systematic theology works. And that's how proper moral ethical thinking works. So the proof texts, what they're really doing, as he said here in the back, Scott did, yeah, in your question, what these proof texts are really doing is giving you the elements that show how the Holy Spirit or Christ has these attributes, and these attributes are unique to God. So that's the typical class. If you perhaps never thought about that before, when we argue about the deity of Christ and the deity of the Holy Spirit, and we're given these proof texts, those proof texts hinge upon that major premise we don't think about, which is that which has the attributes of God is God. So we find those texts that show the Spirit has the attributes of God. We find the texts that show Christ has the attributes of God. That's how we really argue for the Trinity. And that, frankly, is how you argue all kinds of things in theology and biology and in politics and in real life. We just don't talk that way. And I'm glad. It would be very boring life to say, hello there, I have a major premise for you next. You exist. And that which exists, I can talk to you. And I'm talking to you because you exist. No, thank you. So that's the power, and that's what a syllogism is, and all syllogisms are therefore binding, and they necessarily follow from the major and minor premise, period. The Confession talks about that, the Westminster Confession of Faith, and other parts of Christian tradition as well. That's how God made the universe. You can make a major and minor premise out of the Bible, Bible texts and biblical truths and natural law and natural revelation. It is just as binding as finding a single verse. Do you believe that? Of course you believe it, because you believe in the Trinity. Okay, it's another way of saying deductive reasoning and logic. It must follow from the premise. All men are mortal. Pastor Mathis is a man. Therefore, Pastor Mathis is mortal. It must follow from the premises. It has no choice but to follow. A third tool in applying the law of God, these eight principles, is induction. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. Inductions are those things that are probabilistic. For instance, will the sun come up tomorrow? It's not the same thing as a syllogism. You cannot guarantee through logic that the sun will come up tomorrow because the sun could explode. Christ could come back. There could be a solar eclipse or whatever. A lot of science is inductive reasoning, not deductive reasoning. So induction, it likely will occur, or maybe not. And one argument you can see that, for example, is in the Old Testament. There are more arguments, of course, but here's an example. We see Moses, right? And the Israelites come to Moses, and they complain to Moses, as Israel complains to Moses, right? If you think about it, however, did all of Israel complain to Moses? Every single? If you were in Egypt for 40 years, and they started out with this many kids, and we know how many kids they had, it was a lot, of course, and they estimate, therefore, after 400 years, there were 2.5 million people coming out of Egypt at the time, right? 2.5 million. Do you think it's likely that all of them came to Moses and started talking to him? Or is it more likely they sent their representatives, i.e. their elders, to talk to Moses? That's inductive reasoning. It could be strengthened by the text when you find out, oh, there are things called elders. We see elsewhere in Exodus, for instance, and it is there, and that would strengthen the argument all the more. And it even talks about Moses going to the elders, and God has anointed me, he says, right? So that makes sense. That's inductive reasoning, to be more precise. Then lastly, there's another powerful tool that we can use. You have it in your handout there on page 5, the PDF. This is called the argument a fortiori. It's Latin. The English phrase is from the lesser to the greater, or from the greater to the lesser, is what we would say in English, ordinary parlance. It's a form of logical reasoning and has to be used very carefully. You have to know the strength of what is being compared to use the argument. Here's an example of a fortiori reasoning, or from the lesser to the greater in this instance. If this is true, how much more that is true? The Bible uses the language, and we'll go over some of the language. For instance, this example I have for you. If a bike cannot carry two people, it cannot carry three people. Or, to put it more formally, how much more can it not carry three people if it cannot carry two people? That's a more negative example. That's arguing from the lesser to the greater. If a bike cannot carry two, therefore it certainly cannot carry three, the greater. Here's another argument from the greater to the lesser. If a tow rope can move a truck, that is a large vehicle, can be moved with this tow rope, and then certainly a lesser vehicle or a car, a smaller vehicle, can be towed by this tow rope. Yeah, so that's an argument from the greater to the lesser. We use, again, this kind of reasoning all the time. Okay, if cursing parents is wrong, how much more is cursing God? There you go, from the lesser to the greater. You know the implication of this kind of reasoning again. Like the Trinity, you won't find a single verse that says, hey, here's the Trinity, there it is. It's assumed in the Bible, and you gather the biblical evidence together, and you find out, of course, that the Bible is infallible, that there is evidence that each element of God is there and a member of the Trinity, and we have the Trinity, therefore. This is similar. A fortiori is syllogistic reasoning, a subset of syllogistic reasoning. Cursing parents is wrong, how much more to curse God? So, frankly, you don't have to find a single Bible verse that says, thou shalt not curse God. It's there, but it's sufficient if you had the Bible verse that says, simply, you shouldn't curse your parents. Because the moral reasoning is this, don't curse those who are over you. God is certainly over everybody, therefore you can't curse him either. How much more can you not curse him because he is the source of life? Matthew 12:11, here we have something more explicit for you. Who has Matthew 12? Yes, Bruce. Then he said to them, What man is there among you who has one sheep? If it falls into the pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Yeah, he's arguing here, arguing there to the Pharisees and the like. And the Pharisees are like, What are you doing healing a man on the Lord's Day or on the Sabbath? The Old Testament Lord's Day. If you have an animal fall into a pit, you're going to take him out, aren't you? How much more should I, therefore, take care of a human who is of greater importance than an animal? That's the moral reasoning. You think it's okay for a lesser being, for an animal, to be taken out of the pit? But you don't want a human taken out of the pit of moral despair? Physical despair, in this case, is a physical healing. And that's just asinine. You see, we don't always see that when we read the Bible, or parts of that, because our society doesn't teach us to think that way. I know, I went to public school. And it's not just going to public schools. I was taught to think in many regards, and I had hard school classes in public schools, but you're not taught simple logic classes in the categories of thinking and being self-reflective. It's just not required. The closest you get to this kind of thinking is in math. I think logic, a basic 101 logic class, should be for everyone, homeschoolers and alike, and parents as well. Matthew 6:30. Who's got Matthew 6? Yes, Judy. You got it in front of you. Here we go. Now, if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Where's the key word? What are the key words here that tell us that this is logic from the lesser to the greater, a fortiori? That's right. Much more. Will he not much more clothe you? You see that? If it's true for a lesser, then it's true for the greater. If it's true for these plants, how much more true it is for you? They're just dumb, inanimate objects. God cares for those. How much will he care if he has any moral rectitude, which he does, of course? How much more will he care for you? Okay, so that's an argument from the lesser to the greater. Matthew 7:11. Yes, Bob. If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good gifts, good things to those? Ask him. And where is the clue that this is a fortiori reasoning? That's right, there's the word again. How much more? If a wicked person who has very little sense of right and wrong knows to give good things to the children, how much more God, who has the ultimate sense of what is right and wrong, will give good things to you? That's the reasoning. It's in the Bible more than you realize, and Paul uses it in others as well. How much more? From the lesser to the greater. One similar argument, to put it in more practical terms, since none of these things we have disagreements about. For any of my Baptist listeners, I apologize. I don't want to offend you, but I think it's a good example. If children under the Old Testament, through the Old Covenant, were part of a gracious covenant, how much more will they be in the New Testament, which has more grace than the Old Testament covenant? So that's reasoning from the lesser to the greater. If the lesser covenant, which had lesser grace, included children, how much more would they be included in the greater covenant, which has greater grace? Another one. This one is the case combines multiple principles, which is what you do, as it were, in advanced thinking of morality and the law, and what we're going to go through in this class, the limits of submission of government. Matthew 10:24. Yes, ma'am. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. Yes. Disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. And one of the things Christ argues in that regard elsewhere as well is that if you're going to go after me, they're going to go after you, right? If they hate me, they're going to hate you because you're associated with me. You're not going to get off scot-free. But another way of understanding this issue is or issue of ordination, and there are churches in America, lots of churches in America, conservative churches, they don't take ordination seriously. Some guy says, I have this strong desire to be a pastor. Please let me be your pastor. And the church says, okay, there you have it. You're a pastor. Whereas ordination, if properly understood biblically, is a public recognition of due authority, that they recognize you as now being part of that public authority. And Christ himself was anointed and ordained in his office. Remember, John the Baptist did that. And if it's true for Christ, how much more should be true for the lesser our offices? That's our argument. Therefore, for ecclesiology, a particular type of ecclesiology, and Presbyterianism and the like. So, you can see the practical ways in which this tool is used in the church, in the Bible. You put it all together with logical syllogisms and argue from that, and this is what happens when you read the Puritans and Calvin and others. They're making these kind of arguments. This is all a setup, of course, here in Sunday school class, because we haven't gotten to the texts that are for or against just war. resistance of tyrants or armed fighting of all that sort, because it's going to be more than just simply reading the bare text, isn't it? We already see examples of that. You see that now? You got to start realizing that God doesn't give us a Bible in a very limited, superficial sense. Well, I can't find a verse that uses these exact words, Trinity, or argues this and that, X, Y, Z. But it might be there if we pay attention. You just haven't got all the right tools yet. And so hopefully this class has taught you how to use these tools with respect to the Ten Commandments, the laws of God, and theology, so we can understand what he's going to teach us. Another way of arguing from a fortiori, in this case from the greater to the lesser, if the government has the power of the sword for punishment, which of course is death, the death penalty, right, how much more does it have the power for lesser punishment? Right, that's an argument from the greater to the lesser. We know, at the very least, it has the power of the sword. That's the greatest, isn't it? Life and death. Parents don't give him that authority. Under the proper circumstances, of course, and the Noahic Covenant talks about that. He kills another man himself, his blood shall be shed because he killed that man who's made in the image of God. And how much more? This is one of the arguments from one of the reformers, so it's relevant to this class. How much more, then, can they exercise lesser punishments, like perhaps fines? Next, page 6, the handout. There is here principle 4, point 4 of the larger catechism. Question 99. That which is commanded implies that which is forbidden. That which is forbidden implies that which is commanded. That which is promised implies punishment and curses. And curses and punishment imply promise and blessings. It's binary. It's one of the rules I've mentioned that we have here as well. And I've made a number of verses here to go over that. But you can look them up on your own time. I'm not going to go through all these verses. I've given examples already. So the relationship of the law at the very bottom here, point B, it's 7 and 8. We're finishing up Larger Catechism question 9. All this is background for a proper understanding of how to understand the limits of submission to the government. This is quite a mouthful. Point 7. That what is forbidden, it's on the page 8 here, point 7. That what is forbidden or commanded to ourselves, we are bound, according to our places, to endeavor that it may be avoided or performed by others according to the duty of their places. Now that's a mouthful, like a good Puritan. That's how they write, because they're covering all the angles. The confession is long and detailed, because writing a public confession isn't just something you whip out. It takes work, a lot of precision. So that which is forbidden or commanded, right, we've already got that. God says don't murder, God says preserve life. To ourselves, I'm breaking down this point 7 here. To ourselves, read that in the first person, right? To me, Pastor Mathis, I am forbidden to murder. I am commanded to preserve life. I am bound, or we are all bound, according to our places. What are our places? What does that mean? Yes, our station in life. Very good. Your calling, as they would say. I'm a pastor, so my duties are different than your duties. They are broader in some respects, and actually in other respects, they're even more narrower. And what does a rule tell you who to vote for from the pulpit, for instance? I don't believe in binding your consciences. Now, at this stage in America, I don't have to do that because there's other options, apparently, and I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, so I'm more limited. You can run around and tell people who to vote for. So in that sense, my position's more restricted. To endeavor, right, to work, to strive after, that it may be avoided. What may be avoided? Whatever's forbidden or commanded, right? Murder, preserve life, that it may be avoided or performed. Don't murder. Preserve life instead by your station in life. As a pastor, I can exhort people not to murder or exhort people to preserve life. According to the duty of their places, I have an obligation to help you fulfill the sixth commandment. That's the long and short of it. Catch that? Do you think that's significant when it comes to politics? Ah, yes. Because I tell you, a lot of liberals all of a sudden think it's their business to help you how to raise your kids. And they think they're right, right? According to the duty of their places. We have an old liberal president when I was younger, and his wife liked to run around saying, it takes a village to raise a kid. It takes a village to raise a kid. She was right, of course. If I understood correctly, she was right, but that's just it. She's a flaming liberal, doesn't understand it correctly. Conservatives understand it differently. We believe that we believe in our case more precisely to the church and then our community and our villages as well, are supposed to be there to reinforce the authority of the parents, or more precisely of God. That's how you help raise a kid and even help raise the kid if the parents are sick, gone, or they need a teacher. That's what you mean. That's what we mean. That's why slogans annoy me, however, and they drive me batty when they say it takes a village to raise a kid. It doesn't say enough. We're not sure what they're saying. It's too imprecise and therefore not very useful for politicians to say these things, of course, unless they want to hide the truth. Or just anybody, a leader or even you. Sometimes you just confuse yourself because we're using words in such broad language and using slogans, but that's a bunny trail. That's point seven. Point eight is inverted. The perspective is inverted. Point seven is in the first person, right, to ourselves. We are bound according to our places to help you, and you do your duty both to avoid the wrong and do the right. And point eight says that what is commanded to others, that in what is commanded to you, I am bound. We are bound according to our places and callings to be helpful to them, that is to you, and take heed of partaking with others in what is forbidden to them. So now it's flipped a little bit, and it says that what is commanded to others, that would be you, what is commanded to you and others is to protect and preserve your life. I am bound according to my place and calling to help you do that very thing, to protect life and preserve it, and to take heed of partaking with others in what is forbidden them, or to avoid doing that which is forbidden. You see, you have two parts of it, right? What is commanded, that's the positive. What is forbidden, that's the negative. You're never supposed to do what is forbidden, and I'm supposed to make sure. I'm supposed to take heed of partaking with you in what is forbidden. I'm not supposed to help you murder other people or promote the means, causes, and occasions to murder other people. Catch that? Well, I didn't murder anybody. I just joined the association that helps encourage murderers. Oh, okay, that's obviously different, right? Well, there's no commandment against that, you see? People argue like that. I don't know. I just went over some principles, and some of them include the means, causes, occasions, and provocations. Thereunto are also as binding as much as an explicit command, thou shalt not murder. The means, an organization to help encourage murdering, is wrong. The association of the means to help encourage murdering is wrong. Everyone catch that? All this because we have these principles to interpret the law of God aright, and therefore apply it to every particular situation according to our conscience, of course. And what is commanded in others, point eight says, we are bound in our places to be helpful to them. So to flip it in this case, as a pastor, I have a duty to preach to you. You are bound to help me preach to you. Do you know that? That's what it just said, didn't it? As what is commanded in others, I'm the other, the pastor, we are bound, you are bound, and your place is to be helpful to them. You don't have to agree with them, of course. Many of you took the oath before God, and none of you took the oath before God. I agree with the confession like the church officers did. When I'm preaching, I'm teaching you. That's in the Bible and the text and the like. But you are called to be here to help me preach well. One way to help me preach well, of course, is to give feedback, is to encourage me, is to pray for me. You see? We have mutual responsibilities. That's the point of number seven and number eight of the larger catechism question. It summarizes all the biblical data. I'm not going to give you all the verses. You can look up the verses. They're there in the catechism. I haven't gone into a lot of details, but upon first blush, one could try to argue that, hey, that means to murder, a gun is murder, because it's a means. It's a means to murder. But then you realize you have to go into the question of liberty. Then you go into the question of what else does the law say? And I can't answer that all right here, but the question of gun rights and et cetera, et cetera. That's why one of the examples I gave to you is the positive example of going to work. God hasn't specified how to get to work, but you know you're supposed to get to work. Well, I want to walk. Well, sure, you can walk. Is walking bad? If it's bad for you, don't do it. It may be or may not be. It depends on the weather. You see, the thing in itself is indifferent. Guns are indifferent. Walking is indifferent. But the circumstances may make it different and make it dangerous or even wrong. And that would be part of the arguments. Guns are indifferent in themselves. But then another question is, how bad, for whom? Is society wicked enough? Or are we living in the Wild West? And I'll tell you, brothers and sisters, when you read history, as I've read history, they don't all agree on how to apply even these eight principles all the time. You'd be surprised at some of the laws the Puritans passed. You would say, I thought they were conservative. Because the category conservative and liberal isn't historical categories as we know it today in America. Well, we're out of time. If you have any questions, please write them down again, and I encourage you before I have a day or two set up to answer any questions that you have. I'd like to know ahead of time so I can be prepared. Are you ready? Let's go ahead and pray.